Yes, hello, and thanks for having me. I'll talk about various aspects of the design of Australia's carbon pricing scheme and of the implications thereof as well. So it's not to forget. This is actually quite a remarkable thing that happened here this year, quite momentous indeed, right? So because this comes after about 6 years of intensive work on design of carbon pricing schemes, of very intense political debate over carbon pricing in Australia. I'm saying 6 years of that happening intensively. If you look at the roots of the policy development and political proposals, therefore, that goes back well over a decade. Some people would say 2 decades, in fact. And we're now in a situation where it's actually law. So not to forget, as we delving into the details of the legislation and the policy, that this is actually quite something to remark on. And, you know, coming in the country that is, just about the largest exporter of coal by value, very heavy coal user, among the highest per capita emitters in the world. So it's not nothing, really. And all of this has taken place in an environment that has changed, okay? So 2006 to 2008, the levels of public concern and concern about climate change and support for Australia to put in place significant policy action on the issue have dropped. Under Prime Minister Rudd, climate change was the greatest moral challenge of our generation. Now, if you type in clean energy future into Google and hit I'm feeling lucky, then you get to a website that describes the policy and you're greeted by a big banner in green letters that says, how much will I get? Okay. So that, you know, it's different, and in that context, I think it's quite remarkable. So what have we got? This has been mentioned several times before. Starts out with a fixed price permit scheme, then moves to a price collar with a floor and a ceiling. Why the reasons for these things? Well, fixed price was essentially a political compromise between Labor and the Greens, who would not have been able, under any circumstances, to agree on an emissions target. Okay, so fixed price was seen as the one way to get this kind of policy package in place without the need to agree on an emissions target for Australia. Okay, why the price floor? The idea there is to provide greater investment certainty for businesses that want to invest in lower carbon options, in particular in the context of great volatility in international markets, coupled with the strong desire to actually link up the Australian scheme to international markets, because that's the way we do things and that's the way that you achieve the most cost-effective outcomes. Why a price ceiling? Well, in order to provide reassurance that Australian emitters will, under no circumstances, be facing a higher carbon price than what is mandated there under the price ceiling. Now, how does that compare to international permit prices? And international permit prices will be relevant from 2015 onwards, when the scheme will be open to the use of internationally accredited units in Australia. So what I've plotted here is the price lines of EU allowances and CDM credits in Australian dollars. So there's an exchange rate factor in there. And I apologise, I last updated that in October, and a few things have happened to permit prices between October and December. So you've seen, a great amount of volatility here, and then a drop most recently. I checked this morning, it's €6.80 and $4.30 cited on the Point Carbon website. So that equates to, well below $10 Australian. And I've sort of penciled in a forward price curve here. I haven't checked that forward price curve, but, forward prices generally rise at like 4% or 5% a year. So you can see that the price floor, which just at the beginning of this year when we did a lot of work on this, including for the Multi-Party Climate Committee, price floor was seen as a kind of something that just sits there in the background and provides reassurance, has moved to something that, you know, on the basis of current expectations about future prices, might well be what actually determines the Australian carbon price between the middle of 2015 and middle of 2018. Now, where does that take us? Well, it is actually, in my mind, what we've seen in international permit markets, quite a good argument to put more emphasis on price instruments than quantity instruments. I mean, Regina just before told us that the effectiveness of the EU phase two depends on how the recession, what the effects of the recession or feared recession financial crisis might turn out to be this year, next year. And that simple fact that actually, you know, highlights that a pure quantity system in an environment where the targeted cuts aren't particularly big, as is the case with 20% cut in the EU, and in an environment where there's significant policy uncertainty over future extensions to the policy, so that the extent to which expectations about future permit demand uphold current policy prices is a bit compromised because of policy uncertainty, in that kind of environment, is actually a very good argument to be made for price collars or, in fact, price-based policy such as under the fixed price period here. One basic thing to keep in mind in many of the debates that are happening in Australia at the moment about complementary policies and so on and so forth, we have these debates at the moment in Canberra where the ACT government has put forward an emissions target just for the Australian Capital Territory, so a small, relatively small state, or really it's sort of a local government. And what does that do? And the important thing to keep in mind that anything on top of the carbon price, and in fact the level of the carbon price, determines the extent of mitigation action within Australia. Okay, so the more we do on renewable energy support, local schemes for mitigation, et cetera, the higher the permit price is, the more we will dampen emissions growth or potentially, in fact, reduce emissions within Australia, whereas the emissions target itself determines the overall contribution that the country makes to global mitigation, right? And the difference between the two is the amount of permits we buy or the extent that we support mitigation through investment in other countries. Now, on that topic, many of you will have seen this is taken from the Treasury report modelling the carbon price. Top line is their business as usual case that I asked a question of our colleague from DCC this morning. Middle line is Treasury's projected emissions under carbon price. This is from the core policy scenario that starts out at levels around $20 a ton, or whether I think it's about $30 a ton by 2020 or thereabouts. Orange line down here is Australia's emissions target, so that's the 5% target to 2020, and then tracking towards the 80% reduction target towards 2050. And on Treasury projections, about two thirds or thereabouts of the effort in the early years would come from internationally sourced emission reductions. Okay. Now, if that were the case, then there's a very big debate still to be had about what we're actually doing here, and you know how that relates to you know the ambition that we would see among many people in the population who support strong effort on climate change, because I would hazard a guess that for most people, that actually translates into a desire for a lot of domestic action. I, for one, of the view that Treasury's projections here are very conservative, and that we might well end up below this line of projected domestic emissions for two reasons. One, Treasury is only modelling carbon price, not the other complementary policy efforts. And secondly, these kinds of modelling exercises tend to be quite pessimistic in their assumptions. And the typical experience, and Grattan Institute has a wonderful report on this published last year, that shows that in most cases you actually just simply end up in a better position than you thought if you use sensible market instruments. As an illustration of modelling assumptions, here again is taken from the Treasury report, renewable energy supply in Australia under carbon price, okay, so what you get here is about 40% or thereabouts of Australian electricity supply by the middle of the century from renewables, okay, the bulk of that assumed to be from wind and geothermal, and a very small slice from solar thermal. Contrast that with the IEA projections in their latest solar thermal report that puts Australia in the bracket of countries that could have 40% of electricity supply just from geothermal. Okay. At the same time, I haven't had a chance either of really digesting the energy white paper yet, but if you look at one of the most recent articles on the Climate Spectator site there, Giles Parkinson is pointing out how the assumed cost of solar technologies, I think he's talking about PV solar, in the energy white paper, has solar costs decreasing to about the levels that they are currently at already in about 20 years' time. Okay, so, you know, things might well turn out better than we think. I should probably wrap up pretty soon, so I won't go into details about this, but just a quick word about where those international units might come from, because chances are that as a country we will still rely on internationally sourced emission reductions to some extent. The legislation says that it'll be essentially CDM, okay? There's the option for direct linking, and in the policy document you see the EU and I think New Zealand as well mentioned. Now, in terms of direct linking to the EU, one would need to ask the question whether that would actually be of interest to the EU. There's the perpetual issue of different views between Australia and the EU as regards land use change, forestry and land-based activities. So there's this kind of suspicion that we're bending the rules or whatever it may be. And it doesn't really matter if it's justified or not, because that always is an issue. And land use does, of course, come in through the carbon farming initiative that Penny will be telling us more about. So there's a question mark there, I think. And, you know, from our point of view also, you know, this is a point of price volatility. So do we really at this point in time want to hitch our wagon so completely to what's going on in the EU? CDM, of course, yeah, well, the EU is walking away from the CDM pretty much. Concerns about additionality as ever, what is really environmental effectiveness, and perhaps more importantly, CDM doesn't provide incentives for developing countries to come on board with a more comprehensive form of mitigation, and doesn't require a co-payment to the overall cost by developing countries. Rather, it gives profit on top, which is no longer seen as, you know, where things should be. It's, you know, it's been a good way of getting things started, but EU is of the view that one should move on. And I would think that would be a sensible position for Australia as well. The big question is whether we will get new market mechanisms such as sectoral trading or crediting, such as red credits of sufficient quality under the UN umbrella, whether it will be possible to negotiate such market mechanisms, new ones, in a framework that requires the agreement of all countries, or whether it may not be a more practical way of going about it by just entering agreements with a group of countries that have similar interests on the issue, such as Korea, Japan, Indonesia, and other countries in Southeast Asian region as potential sellers of emission reduction units. There is, as always, politics, and I found that really enlightening what Fergus just told us. And just to add on that and finish on that, if you think about, you know, repealing the legislation, then there would be a lot of cost involved in that, right? Political cost, because, you know, if you repeal it, you know, you wouldn't really be able to repeal the increase in the tax-free threshold, right? I mean, that's politically not really possible, so you've got to find the revenue somewhere else. By the time that repeal would be possible, you know, I've heard others who say it wouldn't be possible until 2016 or thereabouts, industry will have gotten used to it, and there will be very few industries that are actually materially worse off because of the scheme than otherwise. So I'm not sure that there would be a big industry lobby, you know, 3-4 years down the track that would actually push for repeal. However, leader of the opposition has, of course, made this a very strong personal commitment. And we've, you know, I mean, many of our senior political commentators, whose judgment I would trust much more than mine, tell us that Abbott will repeal this legislation if he is prime minister, full stop, okay, no matter the political cost or anything else. So, you know, it might just revert back to the question of leadership within the Liberal Party, which was, of course, the decisive element in Prime Minister Rudd's carbon pollution reduction scheme going down. So thank you very much.